Why is the shopping cart always in the top right of the screen?
How do companies predict my purchases?
Why do prices end in 9?
Why do fast food companies use red and yellow in their logos?
Why do restaurants always have one expensive menu item?
Researchers, marketers, and very curious people seek the answers for how we make decisions and how we choose products. ClickSuasion finds the secrets that companies use and shares them with you.
Why do I feel better when I bought the last remaining airline ticket?
How do I make choices based on colors and fonts?
Welcome to ClickSuasion. Today's guest, Dan Ariely. Dan's a 3-time New York Times bestselling author. Doesn't need much of an introduction. His books include Predictably Irrational, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, Irrationally Yours, Payoff, and his current book, or most recent, Dollars and Cents. Dan, welcome to ClickSuasion.
Hello, hello. Nice to be back.
Outstanding. So in your other books, you've discussed this decision-making, psychology, and behavioral economics. For the next book, Dollars and Cents, why financial decision-making?
So first of all, I've discussed some of financial decision-making before. A lot of technology has come about for payment and for electronic transactions that is actually making things more difficult for us. So if you think about a time when we had just cash and we got paid weekly and there were no mortgages and no long-term savings and so on, life was really very, very simple. But as technology is getting more complex, we get credit cards, of course, but Apple Pay and Android Pay, and the financial life becomes more complex, and there's all kinds of things you could do in auto pay. People are making more and more mistakes. And I would say that in general, what guides my research is to look at the loss of human potential. I look at lots of places where we could be living in a better way and we're not for some reason. And I'm trying to figure out, are we living with not to our full potential, and what are the mistakes that we're making? And financial decisions has always been something that we made mistakes, but I think the number of mistakes we're making now are increasing. And especially with our increased longevity, that creates an extra problem.
What are some common mistakes that we're making? And I'm probably guilty of these too.
So there are many. It's all about, so let's start with the basics. To think correctly about money, we need to think about the opportunity cost. Right? And opportunity cost is the question of what else could I do with this money now and later? So in principle, every time you are trying to buy a cup of coffee, you should be thinking, what other usages do I have for this? You know, if you're in North Carolina, $2.50, if you're in San Francisco, $8, what else can I do with this money? And is there a better use than this cup of coffee? And if you come up with the answer, no, there's not a better use than this cup of coffee, then you should go ahead and buy the cup of coffee. But opportunity cost, which is a wonderful thing, it also is very, very hard to think about. So what happens? We just don't end up thinking about opportunity cost. And it's kind of interesting that the essence of money, which is that it is about opportunity cost, is also what makes money so difficult. And if we can't think about money the right way, how do we think about money? The wrong way. And it turns out there's all kinds of wrong ways to think about money. So before we talk about the specific, I want to kind of say why is it so difficult to think about? And then the other piece is that there's something called saving and something called spending. And saving is really just delayed spending, right? It's something that we want to spend later. And if we think about the difficulty of deciding what to spend on, the difficulty of saving is extra hard. And the reason that saving is so difficult is that we are, in general, not very good at delayed satisfaction. You can think about overeating, and you can think about not exercising enough, and texting and driving, and all kinds of things. Basically, waiting for later is not the hallmark of human behavior. We often prefer the now to later. So money is hard. It's hard to think about the opportunity cost, and then saving is extra difficult. And we have to recognize that one of an amazing achievement is the increase in longevity in the Western world. right? Think about somebody who, you know, 100 years ago, life expectancy was very low. Now it's over 80. That's an amazing thing, right? And we don't know, it's not plateaued yet. It might increase by the time you and I are 80. It might be more. So, and the longer we live, the more we have to save for retirement. So think about somebody who starts to work when they're 25 and works for 40 years from 25 to 65. That's 40 years. And then they have 20 years to save for, right? From 65 to 85 or maybe to 95. And it means that for every year of work, you need to save at least half a year at retirement. That's just a lot of saving. Very, very hard to do, very hard to achieve that level. But we can't not do it. We have to, right? And one additional challenge with saving for retirement is there's no feedback loop, right? By the time you get 65, if you made a mistake, it's too late. There's nothing to fix. So we need to really think about it upfront, very, very carefully.
What are some ways that we could be more proactive or make better financial decisions in our younger years to prepare for those years from 65 to 85 and hopefully 95?
Yes. So on the financial side, you know, of course, we need to start saving. And saving is a simple game of saving early, right? It's compound interest is one of the least recognized forces in the universe. But if you start early, compound interest gets you a lot. And that's an obvious answer, and that's clear. I think a more interesting answer is we need to figure out how to temper our adaptation and how to accelerate our spending. And we need to think about those carefully. Now, here's the thing. There's something called the hedonic treadmill. And the hedonic treadmill is the idea that we often think that buying stuff will make us happier, and it does, but for a short term. So you say to yourself, I really want to be happier. What would make me happier? And you say, I want a new car. And you get a new car, and indeed you're happy for 3 or 4 months. And then you get used to the car, you adapt, your happiness goes down to your pre-new car level. Of course, your bank account is not as healthy as it used to be, but your happiness is not increased, and then you're unhappy again. And then you say to yourself, I want to be happier. You say, what would make me happier? I said, last time when I wanted to be happier, I bought a car. It made me really happy. So let me buy a new bicycle. And then you buy a new bicycle and you keep on buying things and doing things and so on. And we call this the hedonic treadmill, which is the idea that you run in place, right? You think you're pursuing something, but in fact, you're running in place. So one of the things that we need to do is we need to figure out how do we spend better. You know, I don't think that spending is about saving is not about dying with the most money. That's not the goal of life. The goal of life is to optimize our happiness with some constraint of how much we're earning, right? And it's not that I want people to save the most. I want people to make reasonable decisions and figure out what to sacrifice and what not to sacrifice. So one thing that we can think about is how do we buy more happiness with less money, or how do we buy more happiness with the same amount of money? And the hedonic treadmill tells us that there are some things that we make mistakes that we think will get us great amount of happiness, but they don't. So for example, think about buying stuff versus buying experiences. You know, let's say you're choosing between buying a new sofa and going on a scuba diving trip. You might be thinking to yourself, oh, you know, if I get a new sofa, I'll have a new sofa, a comfortable sofa for 10 years. That will be great. And if I go on a scuba diving trip, that will be 10 days and then it will be over. And that's, of course, true. But it turns out that from an adaptation perspective, the sofa would give you a little bit of happiness when you get it as new, and then soon enough you'll get used to it. The scuba diving trip will have 3 periods. There'll be the time before the scuba diving trip when you would anticipate it. There will be the time of the scuba diving trip, which will be the shortest of the periods, but hopefully will be fun. And then there'll be the period afterward in which you would reflect on your life and you would feel that you've acquired a new skill and you know something new and you would have something different. And from that perspective, there are experiences that people adapt to less than they adapt to stuff. So figuring out what kind of things we're going to not adapt to and what kind of things we could do to avoid the hedonic treadmill is very important. And another component related to this is adaptation. So imagine that you say, you know what, I'm living in a two-bedroom apartment. Let me rent a four-bedroom penthouse. And you move to renting something bigger and fancier and so on, and life is indeed better. And then you get used to it. But now scaling down is going to be very tough, right? Once we got used to a certain level of life, scaling down is going to be difficult. And I remember when I was in grad school and I got my first faculty job, and I moved from getting, you know, a PhD student stipend to getting an assistant professor salary. Huge jump, right? I was getting, you know, lots more, not that much in reality, but, you know, much more. And one of my professors said, remember adaptation. And he said, remember that what you want to do is you could go ahead now and buy a new TV and a new sofa and, you know, equip your kitchen and do all kinds of things like that. Or you could take your time and do it slowly and therefore enjoy every one of those, any one of the steps. And that's what I ended up doing, both me and my wife. And it was a great decision, because we really got to enjoy things for much, much longer because of that.
If you and I were to go on that scuba trip, how would our financial decision-making change or alter if you and I were to pay for the scuba trip before prepay, pay during, or pay after it was complete?
Yeah. So this is a question about the pain of paying. And the idea is that payment is not just about giving up our money. It's also about how much guilt we feel at the moment. And it turns out that when we consume and pay at the same time, our joy goes down and also our spending goes down. So what happens when you prepay? When you prepay, you feel during the vacation has been paid for. And therefore, you're just free to enjoy it. When you pay at the end, it's also one lump payment. You don't think about it much, but you start thinking about the payment as you get closer to the end of the trip. And you could basically, the end of the trip could be clouded by this, you know, 2 days before the end, you know that in 2 days you'll have to pay for it, right? And the worst, of course, is paying during. Right? If every day on scuba diving, you had to pay separately for your morning dive and separately for the afternoon dive and separately for the books and separately for so on, what is sometimes called micropayment or pay as you go, that will be the worst, because what will happen is you'll think about money all the time. And as another analogy for this, you can think about how we feel about filling our car with gas. And how do we feel about the utility bill at home? And, you know, for the vast majority of people, you know, the gas bill is not as high as their heating and cooling bill, depending on where you live and the size of the house, of course. But what happened is with the pump, you stand next to the pump and you see the thing running and you see the dollars accumulating, right? And you feel bad about it. Whereas energy at home, it's being charged to your account a month later directly from your checking account, and then people don't feel that bad about it. And if you think about this notion of the pain of paying, you can say, should we increase it or decrease it? And you can actually do both, and it's up to us. So you could say, you know what, if you and I are going on a scuba diving trip, let's not suffer. You know, we're doing it. It's a once in a lifetime experience. Let's not suffer. Let's not think about every dive and every dollar and so on. Even if it's going to be a little bit more expensive, let's prepay for it. Let's prepay. And during the day, during the vacation, let's just enjoy it. And that's a perfectly reasonable approach. Now, you could say, on the other hand, if we're doing something that we do frequently, like electricity bill or something like that, you could say maybe those things I want to have a bit more pain of paying. Or you could say, you know what, if I'm going to do something that I want to do less of, maybe I should experience more pain of paying. So it's kind of up to us to think about what we want to do. Do we want to drive the pain of paying higher or lower? Now, the other thing to realize is that we are not alone in the world. And there are other entities who have a goal for us. Right. So, for example, if you think about the new Amazon store, did you see the new Amazon store, the design of it?
I have.
Okay. So what this store is about, it's about getting people to just go into a store and never take a credit card out, never take money out. They just put things in their basket and they leave. That's an ultimate approach of reducing the pain of paying. People don't think about money. Money is not mentioned. You don't see the money and so on. And that for sure would create a high degree of spending and a low degree of saving. Or if you think about credit cards or Apple Pay or Android Pay, many of those technologies are designed to reduce the pain of paying and designed to get us to spend more and save less. So, you know, we could decide for ourselves what kind of pain of paying we want and what kind of guilt and happiness and so on we want to feel. But if we're not going to do it ourselves, somebody else is going to do it for us. And if somebody is going to do it for us, then we should look at it very carefully and make sure that what they want to do for us is what also we want from ourselves.
Well, I don't want anybody to inflict any pain on myself. So how could we avoid painful spending?
But by the way, I'm not sure that you don't want pain of paying, because remember that what the pain of paying is actually part of it is to think about opportunity cost. So imagine that I created a system for you and I say, you know what, you just go ahead in life and spend. And what I would do is I would just charge you direct when you die, I'll take it from your inheritance, or, you know, every year I'll take it at the end of the year and so on. But you don't worry about money. I'm not going to show you how much things cost. It will be like a hospital, right? You go into hospital, they treat you, you never know, you just get the bill at the end, right? That will be a terrible system for you. It's true that you will not feel the pain of paying, but it's also true that you will not have money for retirement. So, you know, if we died early and so on, life will be simple. But given that we need to save for retirement, it's really not a good idea to have zero pain of paying. So some things you could say from time to time, let's not have pain of paying because I want to have fun and not think about it. But as a regular way of living through life, unless we have some pain of paying, we don't think about opportunity cost, and the odds of making the right decision is very, very low.
Well, what about painless spending? Is that a thing?
Painless spending?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the standard example, I mean, the most extreme example is what happens in casinos. You go to a casino, you take $1,000, you put it into chips. And the moment you put it into chips, there's like one big step that you made. But once you have it in chips, it's basically you say, I've lost that money. I don't know exactly when and how, but I've kind of lost. I've accounted for the fact that I've lost that money. And now you just feel like you're spending somebody else's money. So from that perspective, it's very simple, right? And if we could do that, it is basically, it feels like free money, right? And there are some other examples for this. The way people think about tax rebate, right? So tax rebate is money that the government holds for us with no interest, and then we get it back. And but people feel as if it's free money. And when they feel it's free money, they are much more likely to be willing to spend it in an easier way. And sometimes it's a good thing, right? Sometimes it's a good thing to create that, but not always. And we certainly don't want it all the time.
So in dollars and cents, you mentioned that credit cards are similar to memory erasers, but in your wallet. Could you elaborate?
Yeah. So basically, there is this notion in general of what is called a mental accounting. And the notion of mental accounting, this came from Dick Thaler, is that the way that we get money helps us figure out how we can spend that money and what do we feel free to spend it on. So imagine the following scenario. Imagine you work for me and I'm giving you a raise and I can either give you another $1,000 a month or I can give you $12,000 at the end of the year. Which one of those would you prefer? And most people say, you know, the rational thing to do is to get the $1,000 a month. You get the money early, you can save it, you can pay bills, you can do all kinds of things. But when I ask people which one would make you happier, most people say the one that I get the money at the end of the year. And why? Because under those conditions, people feel more comfortable spending it on things that they really want. So if the money comes in your regular checking account, you feel like in the regular salary, in the same stream of income, you feel the need to spend it on the same kind of things. But if it comes at the end of the year, you treat it like a special pot of money. And now that it's a special pot of money, you don't feel the same responsibility. You say, oh, I can spend this on something else. I can go on vacation. I can buy a motorcycle. I could do something special. And that's an important step. Now, I'll tell you one story. In some of this research for the book, most of the research is kind of lab research, but I learned about a person who self-declared herself as being very stingy. And she said it was tough to be stingy. It's tough to be stingy because she would go to dinners with friends and people would, order, and she knew that at the end of the meal, they're probably going to share the meal, they share the bill, and she was like miserable all the time because she would say, oh, this person got an expensive dish and this person got another glass of wine and I'm going to have to pay for it and what is my part? So she would feel inside very, very much stressed over this. And it was really tough for her in her life in general. And one of the things that was difficult was that her family wanted to go on vacation, but spending money on vacation was very tough. So she said, how can I trick myself? How can I make myself to feel that I'm not spending my money? Because when she went on vacation and she thought every $10 and everything she was spending on it would just kill her, it would just take the joy out of this. So she wanted to create a different mental account. She wanted to create a different way to think about vacation money. So what she did was she opened an account in a different bank and she said, this account is going to pay for taxes, home repair, and whatever is left we'll use for family vacation. And, you know, she put money direct deposit every month from her checking account and whatever was, taxes was taxes and whatever was home repair. And every year she had some money left, sometimes more, sometimes less. But that money, she basically transitioned it like to coupons in the casino, and all of a sudden she felt more free to use it. So that's the kind of tricks we can play on ourselves to behave better.
Financial trickery reminds me of the dedication in your book, which is probably one of the favorite parts of my favorite parts of Dollars and Cents. And the dedication is to money, for the wonderful things you do for us, the terrible things you do for us, and all the gray matter in between. What is the gray matter?
Well, the gray matter is a combination of thinking about our brain right, which is gray matter, and of course the gray area between the good things and the bad things. And this is actually the reason why I'm so skeptical about financial. You know, there's some things that we can do with financial advice, but in general, I'm a little skeptical about financial advice, because it really is a very intricate combination that everybody needs to figure for themselves what is their perfect sweet spot. And there's lots of gray zones. So, you know, if somebody is saving zero, that has to be the wrong answer. But if somebody is saving between 10 and 20% of their income, it's hard to tell what's the exact right approach. And so you know, money is amazing. Like when you think about money, think about the advances that we have with money, right? We can save, we can store it, we can get interest, we can specialize, right? We can trade off dramatically different things, right? I can buy a tiny bit of broccoli. I mean, there's all kinds of amazing things that happen because of money. There's also all kinds of things that we do that are really terrible, that are making it very hard for us to live correctly and save the right amount and not overspend, and we take too much pride in money, and we have issues with property and so on. So it's very, very difficult to figure out. But the gray zone is this area when we have to figure out what works for us. And the reality is that it's not easy. And the book doesn't really give financial advice in a kind of Susie Orman way on saying do X, Y, or Z, because I don't believe that's right. I think that the right approach is to say, here's some places where you might be failing. Here's some things that we might want to improve, and let's think about those. And I think that's kind of the right approach.
We've been chatting with Dan Ariely, author of Dollars and Cents. Dan, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you today. Dan, where could we find Dollars and Cents?
So it should be in every store, Amazon, and so on. And more information about me and like that, it's on my website is the best place. And my website is Dan Ariely.com. DanAriely.com.
Visit DanAriely.com. Pick up his book, Dollar and Cents. Phenomenal read. I highly encourage and recommend it. Dan, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much for joining us on ClickSuasion.
My pleasure. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to ClickSuasion. Subscribe to the podcast, read our research, and get in touch with us at ClickSuasion.com. You can also find us on Twitter with the handle at ClickSuasion. You know when your customers are shopping at your business and they pick up a product? The customer holds it, feels it, and shows it to their friend. Then they look at the price tag.
Oh my, I need to look at something else.
The customer picks up a second item and loves the way it looks. They've heard of this product, but haven't yet seen it in person.
I've got to have this!
You're happy the customer chose to buy a product, but you're equally frustrated that they didn't buy both items.
I want them both.
The Consumer Experience Lab at Barbera Solutions designs behavioral strategies that target the consumer's decision-making process. BarberaSolutions.com. Because the opposite of rational is not irrational. BarberaSolutions.com.